Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest will be Frank Warren. I need to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. My guest tonight, Mr. Frank Warren, is the editor and publisher of UFO Chronicles. The UFO Chronicles website has a large volume of information by several researchers included in it. Several of these people have also been guests here on Eye to the Sky. I recommend you check the site often, as there is always current UFO-related news and commentary posted. He has also guest-hosted for Angela Joyner on the Joyner Report, most recently the last couple of weeks while Angela recovers from surgery. I'm looking forward to an energetic and informative discussion tonight, and I'd like to welcome Frank back a second time to Eye to the Sky. And Frank, last night you had a good program with Barwood.
That was a lot of fun for me. And as we said last night, it was a long time coming. I had actually asked her for an interview, I believe over 2 years now, and we just couldn't. We just didn't seem to put things together. And of course, she had the health issue, as she mentioned, with the Lyme disease. And I'm just—I was just really glad to hear that she's doing better, and that was just such a tough thing for her. And I listened to the archive this morning, and listened to her recount the pain and all the suffering she went through. And I thought, my God, she was at her wit's end with that. So it was a lot of fun, and she dropped some bombs last night for the Common Denominator listeners. Anybody that listened to that show. She mentioned some things about Symington that I was not aware of. I did not know that her phones were tapped. The Men in Black thing, in terms of the videotape with the witness, I was aware of that, and we're actually working on that. But that was a very exciting show for me, and hopefully for all the listeners. So it was a lot of fun.
Actually, I had heard her talk about her phones being tapped before.
I had heard that
several years ago.
Yeah, okay.
But the bit about Symington and her thoughts that the charges against him were trumped up, so to speak, and that he was finagled into doing the press conference where he had an assistant or whatever his name was dress up as an alien.
You may have heard it in my voice when she said that. Basically, and of course, there's speculation on her part, but, in essence, she's an insider. She was on the city council, so obviously she knows more than the average person would. There's a conspiratorial facet to what she was saying in terms of, basically, he made a deal to have the charges dropped, and the trade-off was for him to make light of the Phoenix Lights. That's big news to me, period. I was kind of taken aback when we were talking about that. And I've spoken with her, we spoke afterwards and beforehand, and there's going to be more to that. She's already agreed to do a couple more interviews, so I'm looking forward to learning
fantastic.
More.
Oh, fantastic. In light of him coming forward and saying that, yes, he saw the large object that night in Phoenix, and him doing, that press conference, it's like, you're going, well, what side's he on,
Yeah, exactly.
It just really surprised me and a lot of people.
Well, in Phoenix, the Phoenix Lights in general, and I choke almost every time I say that because that's so disingenuous, because it's so much more than lights. And then, of course, it conjures up the videos, the flare videos that everybody sees. But, we're always asked, isn't Roswell a dead horse? Aren't you beating a dead horse? Well, my answer to that is, look, as long as we're pulling out new witnesses from Roswell, no, it's not a dead horse. And that does happen more often than you would think. And, of course, in contrast to the Phoenix Lights, in the scope of things, that just happened. You know, that was 97. So, you know, the majority of the witnesses are still with us, they're still alive. The evidence is much more easily obtainable, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got so many more advantages with that. And another facet that she brought up in last night's show was the amnesia effect. Now, I had heard a couple people experience that, but she named two large groups of people and then also recounted her own personal experience the year following. And that just intrigues the hell out of me, I don't mind telling you.
I agree with that.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. So I just really enjoyed that show and loved the interview last night.
Go ahead.
Well, I just feel there's just so much more to come as I dig deeper into the Phoenix Lights. You just learn more and more. There's just so many different angles to the event, and of course it was a multi-event scenario. And Mike Fortson often tells me, he says, you know more about the Phoenix Lights than most ufologists do, and I always laugh at that because it's so vast. But it is one of the cases that's very intriguing to me, and I do pay attention to it.
And then when you consider that it wasn't just over Phoenix, I mean, it was spotted, you could almost, you know, on a map, draw lines for the course of this thing from Henderson, Nevada, all the way to Tucson, and from there a little further beyond.
Well, and quite frankly, way beyond that. I mean, if you go to spring of 97, there were actually sightings of large V-shaped objects coast to coast, heavily in the states, surrounding Arizona and whatnot. And every year, as I was telling Francis last night, we always turn up the volume for the Phoenix Lights case in March at the UFO Chronicles, and every year without fail, we pull in new witnesses. And it's been several years now, but we did. There was a television producer in Yuma that saw one of the large crafts that in the 8 o'clock hour, I believe, and she said that it was cruising low and slow, like the 8 o'clock witnesses said, and it was heading southwest. So that kind of puts it going into Mexico, basically.
Oh yeah, well that night, as I was saying, though, that particular night. In March of 97, it was tracked from Henderson, Nevada, which is just,
That's Pacific,
you know, the suburb, I guess you could call it, of Las Vegas, all the way to Tucson.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and then beyond. If we go to our Yuma witness, it kept going. We call more witnesses almost every year when we, when we pay heed to it. In contrast to some older cases, with Roswell and whatnot, we're racing against, the Undertaker. Here, this is relatively a fresh case. So, I think we need to pay attention to it. We need to wring this thing dry as best we can. And new things come up all the time. I mean, if you listen to what she said last night, it can't get any better. You've got Men in Black. You've got what most people think is an alien craft. You have psychological effects in terms of amnesia. There were some witnesses that actually felt that there was a psychic bond, a communication between the craft or whoever was in it and themselves. I mean, it goes on and on. It just doesn't get any better than that. It's an exciting case.
Well, and speaking of the Men in Black, that reminded me of the videotape. Did she ever get to see that tape, that video?
She did not, no.
he never made another copy to try and get it to her?
No. No, that was lost in the wind, and he is, that particular witness is in the wind, although we are actively looking for him.
I hope he's found.
I'm pretty good at finding people. In fact, speaking of which, I found one of the witnesses to the Socorro event. I haven't spoken to him yet, but I have located one.
Oh, awesome!
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, he may not want to talk about it. They kind of went off the radar way back when. They got bothered so much with it, much like Lonnie Zamora. They got fed up with it. And how's that for a segue into Socorro?
Oh, I was just thinking the same thing myself. I was just rereading some of the material on the so-called proof of a hoax.
Yeah, well, that's utter nonsense, quite frankly.
That's why I referred to it as the so-called proof.
I don't
believe a word of it either.
I wrote a rebuttal to Tony Bregaglia's initial article, and I consider Tony to be a friend. And before I published the article, the rebuttal, I sent him the copy just so he would be prepared for it. And I said, please, don't take this in any way other than the way that it was meant. It's constructive criticism and a point-by-point rebuttal to his points. Of course, his points were hearsay, I was very disappointed with his presentation of what he thought was evidence, because hearsay is not evidence, period. It's not evidence in a court of law, much less the halls of science. And then he came out with the second piece, heralding the same theme, and it was more of the same. And then he came out with the third piece, which was basically more of the same again. And I thought, my God. And I, at this point, for him, I was worried about any reputation he may have had at that point in time. I got a lot of private emails from some very well-known researchers and thought, what the hell? It reminded me of the Jay Leno show years ago when Hugh Grant got caught with the transvestite hooker. And I realize that this is a stretch for an analogy, but it was that statement that Leno said when he had Hugh Grant on the show, and he said, what the hell were you thinking? And that's how I feel with Tony Bregaglia when he comes up with this stuff in regards to Socorro. It's like, what the hell are you thinking? I mean, and this isn't to say that I don't feel, he found a letter in some archives, and that's fine. Take a peek. Take a look. It should be pursued. You don't want to ignore things like that. But the letter from Linus Pauling, Linus Pauling asked three questions. Sterling Colgate didn't even respond in kind. He didn't send a letter back. He scribbled a couple of sentences back on the same letter and mailed it back. He didn't answer any of the questions. In fact, what he said point blank, he says, one sentence, I should say, is how he responded. He says, I have good indication of a student who engineered a hoax. Student has left. Now, he's not even making a commitment to that one-line sentence. He says, I have a good indication. From that one sentence, Bregaglia, gets into his stance. And he made, and my biggest problem with it is he didn't ask a question. He made a proclamation. The title of his first piece was The Socorro UFO Hoax Exposed. So here we have a proclamation, not, was the Socorro incident a hoax, and then present the evidence or what he thinks was evidence, but he makes a proclamation. And it was laughable at that point. And but again, I'm one of Bregaglia's biggest cheerleaders, and I immediately emailed him, and I said, man, come on, what are you doing? And then, of course, two other articles followed from that point. I don't know. I was very, very disappointed is all I can say. The first thing, Research 101, you've got to address the evidence on the table. And he skirted past all of that and then heralded the hearsay. It was just bad all the way around.
Oh, well, it seemed to me like he was just grasping at anything he could to prove his point.
Well, and that's how it seemed to me. And again, I don't have any problem with the argument. I think these things should be pursued. But he's hinging this whole thing on hearsay. Then he got a couple other people with like mind. You know, he got a hold of New Mexico University Tech alumni that were involved in hoaxes, student hoaxes, decades later. And of course, you know, they echoed the same thing. Oh yeah, well sure, that could be some kind of hoax. Yeah, that sounds like something we would do. Well, you know, big deal. That's more speculation. He started with hearsay, written hearsay, went into oral hearsay, and then had people speculate on the hearsay.
well
that's not research,
problem,
you know.
Well, my problem is he didn't even come up with any names for any of these so-called hoaxes.
Well, because there are none. You're not going to find any names. And people that rallied around that rallied around Sterling Colgate. Well, look at the two men that were talking about this. Well, so what? Some of the you're telling me that a Nobel laureate can't be biased in terms of his thinking. I have no doubt that Sterling Colgate didn't give too much credence to what happened in Socorro. You know, it goes back to the old argument with mainstream science. Well, we can't get there from here, so they can't get here from there argument. Well, you know, that's utter nonsense. 100 years ago, we were running around in horse and buggies, and now we've got our own spacecraft that have left the solar system. You know, you understand what I'm saying here.
Exactly,
it's just,
yeah.
It's just crazy. And again, I've had personal conversations with Tony, and I have no problem with the argument, but let's make it a question. Let's don't make proclamations. And let's do research. Let's do research 101. You know, in the middle of all this, Ray Stanford's been getting hammered, and he was one of the first civilian investigators on the scene, and the work that he's done, anybody that picks up his book on Socorro, in fact, you can't even call it a book. It's one of the most thorough reports that I've ever read. And J. Allen Hynek paid him high kudos for that specific report. And if I was Tony Bregaglia and I was looking into Socorro, the first person I would have talked to would have been Ray Stanford. You know, there's nobody that knows more about Socorro than he does. So, and so says Allen Hynek.
Well, they investigated it. They were there about as promptly as they could get.
Yeah, Ray was there about, the incident happened on the 24th of April on Friday. I think Ray was there Sunday or Monday, if I'm not mistaken. Which is the other thing, by the way. This was one of the most heavily investigated cases in history. You know, the FBI investigated. The FBI was there. Army Intelligence was there, and the Air Force was there. And they all left with a question mark. And believe me, if the Air Force could have pinned this on a hoax, they would have done so. They would have loved to have done so.
Didn't the FBI agent say that, you know, they didn't find any footprints leading to the site or away from the
That's
site,
correct.
But if it was hoax, they came and went by balloon, quote unquote.
this is true. And that's the other part of it. They did the early investigation. They did talk to people at New Mexico Tech. Every stone, no pun intended, was overturned in this case. There was a tremendous amount of research that went into this regards to the investigation early on, and reluctantly, all three factions came to the same conclusion, i.e., it's a UFO, and when I use UFO as they did then, I use it in the verbatim. It's still officially an unidentified flying object, and of course, I can't tell you what it was, but I can tell you with the utmost certainty, it was not a hoax. It was not a balloon. Now, if New Mexico students could make a craft like that, quite frankly, I think they should have just walked over to White Sands and applied for work there, because we would have gotten on the moon a lot sooner.
Oh, I agree. Well, and then you got to consider, too, that people saw this thing in the air before it even landed.
Well, this is another big point to the case. There were multiple events, in fact, coast to coast. There were egg-shaped UFOs seen in 1964 from New York to California, and heavily in New Mexico and surrounding states. And unbeknownst to me, up until just recently, there was a case over Roswell with photographs, which, by the way, is, if you go to the UFO Chronicles and click on the Socorro incident button, you'll find that. And it's quite fascinating. There is a there are photographs of an elliptical-shaped object that were seen over Roswell the month before. Then we have the Madera case. Just days after Lonnie Zamora's incident, that almost identical, a landing, four landing gear imprints, burning plants at the landing site. That was investigated by the Air Force as well. There were landings up in Montana. There was a case where a young girl was burned while watching a UFO. It goes on and on. There was multiple events around that time. It's fascinating. This is one of these cases that just gets your hair up on the back of your neck.
Oh, especially after seeing occupants get out of this thing and walk around, and you know, that would have shook anybody to their core.
Exactly, and it did. This really frightened Lonnie Zamora. And the other thing, to his credit, and of course most of our listeners, I'm sure, realize or have heard that Lonnie Zamora has recently passed away, but everybody across the board, the FBI, Army Intelligence, the Air Force, the civilian investigators, his co-workers, everybody, just they had nothing but good things to say about Lonnie Zamora and his character, and nobody questioned him as a witness. In terms of him making, you know, making anything up, or if he was part of a hoax or that kind of thing, everybody felt he was a credible witness and said so.
Well, here's a very poignant question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Gossamer, and he asks: in any of these other reports, were markings like Lonnie described on the side of the craft seen on any of these other sighted craft?
You know, not to my knowledge, but that. There's a good point in that, and this is something that Ray Stanford theorized, and of course he had the inside scoop because he had talked to all the investigators. He reckoned that there's a big hoop to do going on about the insignia that was seen on the craft. And we have the parabolic thing with the triangle that supposedly was written by Zamora, and at this point in time, I believe that was the real symbol. Then we have the triangle with the three lines across. Now, Ray speculated that Holder, who was with Army Intelligence, and we know for a fact that Lonnie was told not to talk about the little guys and not to talk about the insignia. And Ray suggested that Holder have another insignia published in the newspaper, so if there was another case, that if somebody came up and said, well, yes, there was an insignia, and if they drew it, and if it was the real one, then that would lend credence to that, to another case when that came up. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there were no other insignias mentioned. That doesn't mean that didn't happen. There was nothing publicized in any of the records that I have in terms of old newspaper clippings and any of the Blue Book files. But I thought that that was pretty bright at the time. And now Ray feels that the triangle and the three horizontal bars across is the real symbol. And I disagree with that. And the reason I disagree with that is because if we go back to the original Blue Book files and Hynek's report, it shows the one with the little umbrella or the parabolic symbol. I think that's the real one. I think Ray's on to something. I think I think they did, in fact, put out a false symbol, and it makes sense that they would do that. In fact, even Kevin Randall, when I interviewed Kevin Randall the week before, he said the same thing. And bear in mind, he was in an Army intelligence himself. He says it just stands to reason they would do something like that. And then that way, if there was another sighting and somebody did mention a symbol, they could ask that separate witness to draw the symbol, and if it was the real one opposed to the bogus one that was published, then that would lend credence to that sighting. And I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense to me.
It does to me as well. Just like in a police investigation, they never report all of the details to the newspapers and the TV news. That way, you know, they have some little tidbits that they can prove, you know, one way or the other, if this is, you know, done by the person claiming they've done it, you know.
Exactly.
That way they can weed out the nuts from the real suspects.
Well, and then, too, remember, we're in 1964, we're talking about UFOs, we've had a debunking program going on, actually, you could go back to Foo Fighters in terms of releasing information. You know, so it just stands to reason. They're going to try to keep some of this hush-hush. And they did. And we know that from the interviews done with Lonnie. He was told not to talk about the little guys, and he was told not to talk about the insignia. That's a fact. That's in the Blue Book files. There's no disputing that at all. And he has, in fact, later on said that he was told not to talk about it.
Interesting. Very interesting.
It is. It's a fascinating case.
Earlier you mentioned people keep saying, oh, why do we always bring up Roswell? Aren't we beating a dead horse? You know, that kind of thing. In my opinion, if you'll pardon the expression, but Roswell is the poster child for cover-up.
Yes, I agree.
You know,
well,
but
on the same token, and my argument is, look, as long as we can still get new witnesses, then it's not beating a dead horse. I mean, for God's sakes, we learn things about dinosaurs, you know what I mean, in
Definitely.
Terms of archaeology. So I just don't buy that we're going to be beating a dead horse. I still get witnesses from the Battle of L.A., which is one of my pet cases. I interviewed the final survivor in the Maury Island incident. The last, you know, there were four guys on the plane. He was the very last survivor, and I don't know if he's still with us today, but I interviewed him a few years ago. And he actually carried what was then called the disc bits, the alleged flying saucer debris. He was the one who put it on the plane. And when I interviewed this guy, I can't even begin to tell you how excited I was. And although he was in very bad health and he was wheelchair bound, when he recounted the event, he took me back as if I was there. And I even commented on that. I says, wow, your recollection of this thing is just fantastic. He says, well, you know, two things. And I says, what's that? He says, well, number one, I've never jumped out of a plane before up until that night. And I says, wow, no kidding. And he says, you know, the other thing is he says, you know, the plane crashed. He says, so not only am I jumping out of the plane, I'm jumping out of a plane that took two men to their death. He says, it's not something that you forget. And, you know, and people had given up on that case, you know, many, many years ago. Your armchair researchers say, well, so-and-so did the research. He said it was a hoax. That's the end of that. And, I always dig a little bit deeper. And we're up to between 8 and 10 witnesses on the Maury Island incident.
Really? Because I'm one of those fence-sitters. I haven't made up my mind whether it was a true incident or a hoax.
Based on my own research, certainly it wasn't a hoax. Based on my research, that happened. And I've got witnesses to back it up. But again, I always tell everybody, you have to do your own research. Don't go by he said, she said. You've got to dig into this thing yourself. And I also got a hold of Harold Dahl's daughter, and she took care of Dahl to his last dying day, and she told me point blank that he never let go of ufologies and his feeling. He told her point blank, these are factual things. He believed that there was life. He was verbatim, that there's life you know, on other planets, et cetera, et cetera. And these are things, I mean, he brought these things up, and they were estranged most of their lives. So there was no reason for her, for him to even talk about these things. But he was coming to the end of his life, and he shared some things with her. And, you know, just it was, it's the preponderance of the evidence, in my view.
Well, were the disc bits ever recovered from the crash?
They did recover some what was called the disc bits when they did the initial search and rescue after the plane crash. But I do not believe anything was put on the plane to begin with. It was Chrisman that handed Davidson a box that supposedly had the debris in it, and I don't believe it was the real deal, again, based on my own research. So I don't think there was anything in there to begin with. And, of course, the plane crash was just a horrific accident. The Mitchell B-25 had a factory defect in the stacks. In fact, I have the Air Force order that they had to weld all of these stacks of everything that was in the inventory because it was a very common problem with the Mitchell B-25, and that's what happened. They were rushing back to get that their plane was going to be an Air Force day for the birth of the Air Force on August 1st, 1947. And because of the crack, the flames shot out of that engine, went down inside, and ignited the oil, and that was the end of that. But, you know, many people attributed that to sabotage or something to do with UFOs, and it had nothing to do with that whatsoever. It was just
a fluke.
It was a fluke accident. However, now that said, Davidson's mother, because I've been in contact with the family, in fact, they reached out to me, which was a nice bonus and surprise a few years back. But his mother always believed to the day she died that the UFO people had something to do with his death. So you just got to wonder what he shared with his mother, if in fact anything. I mean, obviously, you know, he was a CIC agent, so he couldn't say much, but he certainly said something. But she believed that that they had something to do. And the family members that contacted me also, when they reached out to me, contacted me with that in mind. And I said, no, that had nothing to do with it, other than the fact that they were doing their duty. And let's remember, they were the first, they were one of some of the first military ufologists. They were investigating the UFO sightings that happened at the time of the Kenneth Arnold sighting, or what we call the birth of modern-day ufology. So they,
well, that was long before Blue Book and Sign and Grudge and any other UFO investigative people.
Well, it wasn't long before, but yeah, it precipitated that.
You know, in fact, Kenneth Arnold was one of the people investigating it.
Yes, he was. And, yeah. Well, then they flew. They flew to Tacoma to meet with Kenneth Arnold. Kenneth Arnold called Davidson and Brown, and they flew up to see what he was talking about, and then on their way back, that's when they met their demise. And here we, you know, and of course, the point being that this is another case that, as far as I'm concerned, it's not beating a dead horse. But, you know, I've done my own research, and we're up to 8 witnesses that were underneath the 5 craft that Dahl and Chrisman saw. And the other point with Maury Island, of course, that's the first incident of the Men in Black. And in addition to the Man in Black that threatened Dahl, one of the other witnesses was also threatened. And I have that in writing from a family member of one of the other witnesses.
I wasn't aware of that aspect.
Well, this is why we all need to do our own research. There's a lot that the layperson or even the average ufologist just doesn't know, because they, you know, they take things for granted. You know, the Maury Island case was put to rest a long time ago. Most people do. In fact, most sober researchers just assume it was a hoax. Well, I'm here to tell you it wasn't, and I think I can make the argument quite well based on the evidence. Another case in point that I'm heavily involved in is Aztec. Everybody thinks that the Aztec case hinges on Silas Newton and Leo Gabauer. And I'm here to tell you, you can take those two people right out of the scenario altogether. And the preponderance of evidence in support of the Aztec case is overwhelming. And we'll be reading about that soon when Scott and Suzanne Ramsey publish their book, which should be out at the beginning of next year.
Oh, interesting. There's another one I'm going to have to look for to add to the collection.
Oh, it's going to be, it's the compilation of over 20 years of research, so it's going to be exciting.
One quick question that left on the Murray Island. I had heard that the box that they put the fragment in was, of all things, a cereal box. Is that true?
No, it was actually, did you say cereal?
Yes.
Yes, it was, but it was a case. It wasn't just a cereal, independent cereal box. It was a case.
Okay, gotcha.
It was a cardboard box, basically.
I keep picturing like a cornflakes box, you know?
Yeah. It was basically a case that, say, a dozen cornflakes boxes would go into.
Okay, that clears the air. Okay. That's something that always kind of...
It did me the same thing, and I specifically looked into that.
Oh, well, then you were the same opinion that I was.
Yeah, I thought it was odd, but it was, in fact, a cardboard box that held a case of however many boxes came in a case back in those days.
So then it must have been a significantly sized fragment.
What I think it was, I truly believe it was just lava rock. Because when I interviewed the last remaining survivor, he carried that box on board the Mitchell B-25, and he said there was nothing to it. He wasn't impressed with it at all. He said it just looked like lightweight lava rock to him, and I believe that's what it was. I don't think that they put anything on there. Yet bear in mind that Dahl was threatened by the so-called Men in Black or the government man. As most of the witnesses called him. And he was very, very apprehensive about cooperating with Davidson and Brown. And contrary to popular thinking, Crispin worked for Dahl, not the other way around. Most people think that it's just the opposite, and that wasn't the case at all. Dahl was the senior of the two, and Crispin did, in fact, work for him when he got out of the service.
So, what exactly did this fragment, did the real fragment, not just the lava rock, but the real fragment supposedly look like? I've heard several different descriptions.
This is speculation on my part, but we have many, many cases where there has been ejecta involved with then flying saucer cases. Jacques Vallée, I forget which book it was in, but he did a big investigation on more than a dozen cases where there was debris falling from flying saucers and aka UFOs. Now, it's interesting. There's certain things that can create energy that in regards to chemical decomposition where you have leftover debris. For example, you can take gallium-coated aluminum and make hydrogen out of that. And that you can drop, take a paperclip, an aluminum paperclip, two of them, hook it to a 9-volt battery, you know, a little square 9-volt battery, put each end in a cup of tap water, get a little piece of pure aluminum, coat it in gallium, which is malleable at room temperature. It's almost like mercury, although not as caustic. And then drop that in this electrified, basically what you have at this point almost is electrolysis, and drop it in the water, and you'll create hydrogen. And of course that hydrogen can be used for many things, but one other thing it does is it will ignite. You can actually put a lighter to the top of it, and as the nitrogen bubbles up, you'll hear it pop. Very simple experiment. When it's all said and done, you can actually take that aluminum. At that point, it turns into alumina, and you can reuse the ingredients again. So I often wonder if the ejecta that is often seen by witnesses, and there's numerous cases that have talked about this. Again, Vale did research on that specifically and highlights it in one of his books. I'm wondering if that's actually the aftermath of part of the propulsion system, if in fact it's chemical decomposition. And again, it's just speculation on my part. The other thing that was seen during the Maury Island incident, aside from the harder, heavier debris, was newspaper type debris, or you know, a paper type, or a very thin type of debris. So there's two types of debris that came out of the disabled saucer at that point, according to eyewitnesses. Now, some researchers have argued, and remember, then we have a couple of months later, then we have Roswell. And I often wonder, and other researchers have brought this up as well, are we talking about the memory metal, the thin piece of material, aluminum-looking material that was cited at Mariana? Is that the same thing? It's another facet, and you have to wonder if these two things are connected. And again, the whole Maury Island incident is about a craft that was in trouble. It was having problems. And then a couple months later, you have a crashed saucer a la Roswell. Was that the same craft? Were these all these crafts that Kenneth Arnold saw nine? Were they having some sort of problem? In Earth's atmosphere, if we want to say it was ET, was there some kind of common problem with all the craft, or was this the same craft? You know, it goes on and on.
There's so many ifs and what ifs or could be. You know, that.
You know, welcome to ufology.
Yeah.
I'll throw in another if for you. When Davidson and Brown and Dahl and Crispin were in the hotel there in Tacoma, yeah, Davidson pulled out photographs of the Rhodes photo that was published in the Arizona Republic back in that time.
Mm-hmm.
Dahl turned around and said, "That's what I saw," or not Dahl, rather. Kenneth Arnold said, "That's what I saw. One of the craft out of the nine resembled what Rhodes took a photo of." Now, you can make the argument, depending on how you look at the Rhodes photo, for the listeners that are familiar with that, it looks to me as if there is an opening in the center of that craft. Rhodes, by the way, up until a couple years ago, was still alive. In fact, he's on my list to interview, if in fact he's still with us. I was told by another researcher, and of course the Rhodes photo, for your listeners that aren't hip to that, it looks like a heel-shaped object. And I was told that, contrary to popular thinking, that the craft was not flying with the rounded heel part. That wasn't the front of the craft. It was actually flying the reverse, where the heel part, the concave part, was in the forward motion, which I thought was fascinating. But if you go back to the description of the Maury Island craft, one description was as if it was a compressed inner tube, depending on the angle, and of course you had an opening in the center of that. Then if you look at the Rhodes photo and think of that description, are we talking about the same craft? Then you have Kenneth Arnold stating emphatically that was the same craft he saw with his sighting. So, is that a common denominator across the board? Was the Rhodes, Kenneth Arnold, and the Dahl sighting all the same type of craft? There's another big what if.
Interesting. Now, I had never really compared the three.
cue Twilight Zone music.
Oh, gosh. Let's see, we've got about about 3 minutes until, no, wait a minute, top of the hour. Sorry, excuse me, about 8 minutes before we go to the break.
Okay.
Of the three cases that we've discussed so far, which one strikes you as the most interesting?
Well, I think they have, each case has its own facets that are interesting, irrespective of the others. I couldn't say, you know, one rises to the top of the others. They all have specific ingredients to themselves that I find fascinating. But as a whole, what's really fascinating is I don't think any one of them are hoaxes. And again, I base that on my own research. I don't, if you go back to the naysayers, or what Stan would call the noisy negativist, if you look into their arguments, you find out that they haven't done any research. So it's almost like arguing with one of our standard debunkers like Shermer or Shostak. If you get down to the core of their arguments, you'll find that they've admitted publicly that they really haven't done the research. So if you're going to come and make the debate, or if you want to come to the table, then you've got to go do the research. It's almost like criticizing a book without having read it. So I never say never to anybody. If somebody makes an argument about something, and if I haven't looked into it, then I try to hold my tongue, because there may be something there.
Good
to
philosophy.
Me, that's just research 101.
Good philosophy. I wish the people like Magaha and Bill Nye and Shostak and all those others would follow that philosophy.
Well, you're singing to the choir.
Pretty much, yes. Excuse me. And unfortunately, those individuals are not members of the choir.
Well, it's almost an oxymoron, particularly, and I have respect for Seth Shostak, but, you know, I years ago when he debated Stan, I wrote, oh my goodness, his name escapes me, the fellow that founded SETI originally.
Oh, gosh, I can't hear his name either. I am horrible with names.
David, you're out there in the room.
Was it Drake?
Frank Drake, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, those
members,
those
were great, David.
If I could find them. Yeah. Anyway, I after that debate with Shostak and Stan, I wrote to Frank Drake, and he was kind enough to respond, and I says, you know, why is it that the evidence, or the rules pertaining to the evidence, changes between astronomy and ufology? And he was kind enough to respond, and he made a few points, and then I hit him back with both barrels, and then he didn't respond again. And my argument to him was that there's just an abundant amount of hypocrisy. You know, let's take the topics out, and let's just proceed using scientific methodology. That's all anybody ever asks for. Let's take the cognitive bias out, and let's just look at this thing from a scientific perspective. I mean, science demands that we look into these things. And I've often told people, particularly if they're speaking in public, don't dive into the deep end of the pool. Take baby steps. Don't argue about extraterrestrial civilizations and the Federation and all that nonsense. Not to say that that might not be the case, but let's stick with UFOs. Let's get to a point where we can agree, and let's get our opponent's head nodding in the affirmative. And one thing, in fact, I told this to James Fox about three or four episodes ago on Larry King. I said, don't get in the argument about ET. Stick with UFOs. and what will happen, because you don't have, you know, one thing Larry King does is he puts six people on there, and by the time you take commercials out of an hour, you're left with about 45 minutes, and you've got all these puppies fighting at the food dish, and you can't make your argument in that time anyway, particularly if you're going to get into the extraterrestrial hypothesis. You'd need all day. So my argument to him was, or my advice to him, I called him, I emailed him on his cell phone, on his BlackBerry, right before he went on, and I said, look, stick to UFOs. And he did. He took my advice, stuck to UFOs. The regular debunkers that were on, I think Shermer was on that first time, he had nowhere to go, because you can't argue about UFOs. And all they could do was agree with him, you know. Well, that doesn't mean, you know, the little guy from Planet Zircon was driving that UFO, and James turned around and said, that's not my argument. I'm talking about the reality of UFOs, which you can't deny. And Shermer just, you know,
Well, another thing when you get, well, using Larry King Live as an example, you get the pro and the con. You know, the pro side, the con side. It seems to me that the pro UFO or the UFO existence people are usually polite and cordial, and the debunkers turn into loudmouth, rude, interruptive jerks.
Well, I've seen it. I think what happens is, and in fairness to everybody, people that have spent decades doing research, you know, they are emotionally involved in this. So it's very easy to lose one's temper in these circumstances. And I've seen that happen, in fairness to the debunkers. I've seen that happen on both sides of the table. You can't help it. In fact, I've screamed at the television myself when some of these people, particularly McGahey, gets on there and just, and you know, I mean,
that guy irritates me.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, he just utters nonsense, and now of course we have Bill Nye, who has no clue what he's talking about. And what I don't get is, you know, why you know, if Larry King brings on, if he does a religious theme, it's not mandatory that he brings on an atheist. And if you think about that. I've been very critical of Anderson Cooper on his take when he decides to do UFO shows. Well, he did a UFO show, and then the next day he did a show on religion. Now, get this, I've read the transcript, and I searched the transcript. He did not use the word believer once on the religious show. Yet the UFO show, he used the term, the verb believe and the noun believer all throughout it. And here we're talking about, there's no argument about religion being faith-based. How is it that the noun believer or the verb believe never came up in a religious segment on a show where it's used repeatedly when we're talking about UFOs?
I agree. And even on my website, I've got a little logo on there that says UFO research is not a belief system. And on that note, we need to go to a break. Good timing, huh?
Yes. Perfect segue.
And we'll be back here in about 9 minutes or so with Frank Warren, and we'll pick up the discussion when we come back. So please stay tuned, and we'll be back here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now, here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UTRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Frank Warren. Frank, one other thing that we had agreed on talking about this evening, which is something that, frankly, I find kind of appalling, is the MOD ended their UFO investigation as of December 1st.
Right.
And closed down their telephone hotline and their email reporting center. I know my views of the implications of this. I'd like to hear your views of the implications.
I don't, you know, this may be a shock to our listeners. I don't think it's that big of a deal, and quite frankly, I don't think it's unexpected either. It's refreshing that, in contrast to the United States and or the United States Air Force, that they still officially did investigate UFO sightings. But as like we were talking about during the break, the public would never hear about any juicy investigations. That would never come to light anyway. And it's almost oxymoronic for them to make the statement that they will no longer investigate UFOs. I mean, that's utter nonsense. They would be derelict of duty if the RAF, you know, if there was a unidentified aircraft in a sensitive area, or for that matter, any unidentified aircraft, you know, that was recorded on radar, they're going to send planes after it. Period. To say that they wouldn't is just stupidity. It's nonsensical. So UFO investigations by the powers that be are not going to stop. There just isn't a public resource for somebody, for the average Joe citizen to make a phone call. And as we were saying during the break, undoubtedly, like they do in this country, they'll probably, when somebody does make a call to the police department or wherever any official source, undoubtedly they'll be handed off to a civilian investigative group like Bufora or somebody like that, or in our case MUFON or NUFORC, you know, Peter Davenport's organization.
In referring to the article you put on here on UFO Chronicles, can the Ministry of Defense really close down UFO investigations? I don't know if I can find it again. Here it is. There was a statement that the ministry said, and this is quoting from your article, "The MOD has no opinion on the existence or otherwise of extraterrestrial life. However, in over 50 years, no UFO report has revealed any evidence of a potential threat to the United Kingdom." Now,
which is utter nonsense.
Yeah.
You could flip one, if you had all that in a file, and you could go back to the files that they've released, and remember, these are the softball files. Again, the public isn't going to see, you know, the really gritty cases. That's a matter of national security. You'll never see them in the UK. You'll never see them in this country. So here, I mean, we know about shoot-down orders that have actually come out of the softball files that have recently been released by the United Kingdom. So on one side of their mouth, they're saying, you know, there's no threat to national security. On the other side, they're admitting issuing shoot-down orders and the recording of unidentified aircraft in sensitive military installations. I mean, we can go back to Rendlesham, you know, for that matter. And, of course, the same thing is duplicated here in this country. We've got shoot-down orders. We've got blue book files full of UFO sightings around nuclear missile bases, et cetera, et cetera. So the question I posed in that article was, you know, what do they deem a threat to national security? I think an unidentified flying object at a nuclear weapons base falls into that category.
Well, exactly. It's like, for an American example, during the Hudson Valley flap, if you will, a huge object was reported over Indian Point nuclear power plant. And at one point, the security team was told to stand by and get ready for firing upon the object.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? Here's these guys, some armed with shotguns and others with pistols, you know, opening fire on one of these things?
Well, and to draw focus to, I mean, even civilian nuclear power plants, it harkens back to Three Mile Island. I mean, any accident or worse at a nuclear power plant is a threat to national security. and I mean the potential for a multi-state catastrophe is there. So again, how do you define a threat to national security? I mean, what the hell are these people talking about, for God's sake?
Exactly.
How stupid do they think we are? That's the other question.
And then again, referring to your article, the next paragraph I felt was kind of silly. It says there is no defense benefit in such investigation, and it would be an inappropriate use of defense resources. Furthermore, responding to reported UFO sightings diverts MOD resources from tasks that are relevant to defense. I think that is, again, oxymoronic when you consider, you know, that most countries' defense budgets are, well, if you stop thinking about it, more than the gross national product of a lot of third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only, the MOD was only spending about 50,000 pounds a year on the UFO department, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, and much like Blue Book, you had Quintanilla and a secretary and one or two investigators. It's literally laughable. So it's almost that particular paragraph that you just read, if you read between the lines, to me it sounds like there's an agenda. There's a dumbing down effect involved in that, where in regards to the public at large, they want to reinforce the notion that there's nothing to ufology or UFO sightings, etc. We, of course, know better. And again, you've got the left hand and the right hand battling each other, because they've just released all these what I call softball files. But even if when you call some of the cases out of those softball files, there's some very, very interesting cases. And this is with the notion, in my belief, which is speculation on my part, but there's a tremendous amount of evidence that shores up the notion that anything, well, it goes back to the Bolander memo, and anything in this country, anything that affects national security will not go through the Blue Book system at all. One would think that the same structure and methodology exists in the United Kingdom. So we're not getting the best of the best cases. Having said that, there's still some fascinating cases with the recent files that they've released. You almost want to say, look, guys, read your own files. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. So it's laughable to some degree.
Definitely. Because, like you were saying, you know, Blue Book didn't get the really significant cases. In my opinion, in some of the research I've been doing, I think that the really significant cases went to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and was investigated by I hate it when my brain just goes on pause.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Oh, it happens to me more than I'd like to admit.
You're not thinking of the AISS, are you?
Yeah, thank you. That they did all the investigation and all the follow-up, and they reported it to either the CIA or an MJ-12-esque board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then again, I could be wrong, but there's a lot of documentation pointing that Blue Book wasn't the only thing going.
Well, but most sober researchers that have been around the block, and I've got the gray hair to prove it with what hair I have left, believe that Blue Book was just a PR office.
Oh, exactly.
And I believe that, and I think there's enough documentation on the table to support that. And at the same time, with the UFO hotline, the desk that the MOD had, I think that's the equivalent there. So closing that down really is not going to have any bearing at all to the covert investigation that they will do in regards to UFOs. I mean, it's almost, it's just silly for them to say that they wouldn't look in, they wouldn't stop doing UFO investigations. That's utter nonsense, particularly in a post 9/11 world. I mean, if an unidentified aircraft comes into British airspace, believe me, they're going to be all over it. I mean, it's ridiculous for them to make that statement.
I'm not all that familiar with the modus operandi, if you will, of how the MOD would investigate civilian UFO reports, but did they ever really send people out to go question witnesses and take measurements and collect evidence?
If you go back to what Nick Pope has said, that most of it was done via the telephone. Obviously, and this I think is where we separate the wheat from the chaff, I think cases that were more significant would leave the PR desk, so to speak, and would go into higher ups' hands. Basically, the equivalent of what was then the AISS in this country, which of course has evolved and under a new name now, but and again, you're for example, somebody calls in and they see the Chinese lanterns, and they call the MOD desk and somebody takes a telephonic report and they get all that down and whatnot. If it's not that big of a deal, that's the end of story. On the other hand, if you get a Rendlesham type incident, then they call out the heavyweights. And it leaves the so-called UFO desk that say Nick Pope may have had or the other. In fact, I think since they had a UFO desk, and there's been 30 people that have manned it. I was monitoring some of the British lists that were talking about the closure and whatnot. But I don't really see that. It's a little bit of slap in the face. It was nice to know that that the Brits still could say that they officially investigated UFOs. But let's face it, they're still going to. They're not going to stop, no more than the United States government did. It's plain and simple.
You know, I wonder how deeply the MOD investigated Rendlesham Forest.
I think they, as deep as one could go, I think they did a thorough investigation of it. But, how thorough that was, we'll never know, or at least not anytime soon. Again, that's, we've been talking about some heavyweight cases, and speaking of heavyweight cases, that's one of them. And, the other part of it, too, they weren't supposed to have nuclear armaments there, or we weren't, and we did. So that's another little mucky-muck that they don't want to get involved with or make light of.
I thought that was interesting that it took a while for them to admit that, yes, there were nukes there at Waters and Woodbridge, in Woodbridge.
Well, and that opens up a whole other can of worms with ufology in general when people start admitting things. Then they're going to have to go back and say, well, guess what?
We have to admit that there was something there that night in December 1980.
Exactly.
The whole idea of this, the shutting it down, for the reasons that they're claiming, just irritates me. I mean, to the point of not figuring out how to express myself on it.
It is frustrating, and it's but you have to see it for what it is. I mean, it's silly. I mean, I completely understand how you feel. But again, it may end up being a good thing, like we were saying during the break, perhaps the civilian agencies at that point will pick up and actually get some work done.
That would be interesting to see how quickly the amount of reports come into Bufora, which is the British version, I guess you could call it a MUFON, and other civilian UFO groups, investigative groups in all over Great Britain.
In fact, the first thing that I did when this came to light is I got a hold of David Clark, and of course he is. I've got phones ringing all over the place. Pardon me for that.
That's okay. We've got noisy neighbors. I'm surprised half the time people don't hear that here in the apartment.
Well, when I know I'm going to be on a show, I try to shut everything off, and I let that one slip by. This is, of course, it's big talk here, and it's big talk across the pond, but... let me read here what David says. He says it's inevitable. It's an inevitable victim of public spending cuts and demands for all resources to go towards providing kit for foreign wars. Of course, what the stories miss is that the MOD will continue to look at reports from military sources and air defense radar as they have always done. So he's basically agreeing with what I just said. This just underlines the fact that they are not interested in wasting time receiving reports of lights in the sky from members of the public, which have been filed away with minimum attention, usually a standard letter response only, since at least 1974. And I agree with part of that, because the Brits over there, and we're following suit, have a tabloid news print media. And every little light in the sky, and you know, being a platform for producing a lot of the news, I see some of the silliest reports all the time. You know, the Chinese lanterns, the orange orbs, and this is not to say that there's not wheat in the chaff, but there's certainly a lot of chaff, and it gets repeated all the time. So it could be, in fact, that they're thinking, well, you know, out of sight, out of mind. If we can stop this, perhaps we'll get it out of the mind of the media. And like I said during the break, you've got to wonder if somebody, you know, some kid in the background, I always envision the smoke-filled rooms with the colonels and the generals thinking, you know, how can we get the topic of ufology out of the public's mindset? And some guy in the back says, well, how about we just get out of the business altogether? You know, and I often wonder if that was the case with the termination of Project Blue Book. You know, at least when we had an official body looking into ufology, one of the benefits of it is mainstream scientists weren't afraid to talk about the subject. It suppressed the giggle factor, if you will. And many people argue, well, even if we did start up another Project Blue Book, or if the government did start looking into these things, it would just be another front. What good would it do? One good thing it would do is it would break that barrier down for mainstream science. So I look at that as a positive thing. At least they would be not afraid to talk about it. They would take the giggle factor away. You know, a mainstream scientist would say, well, look, our own government is involved in investigating these things, as was the case pre-1969 in this country.
Well, and then David just sent me an interesting thought of his through a PM, so I could get it word for word for us all, that goes right along with what you were just saying. And he said to me, I wonder if the MOD already had plans to close the UFO desk before they started releasing files. Part of a planned agenda to move out of the public light?
You know, that wouldn't surprise me. That makes a lot of sense to me. It probably was premeditated from a long time back. You know, they want to wash their hands of it. They're going to say, look, this is what we've got. We're not hiding anything, and there's nothing to it, so we're going to wash our hands of it, and that's our position on it. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, like David just said, so they can investigate in peace.
Exactly. Sure. You bet.
Covertly, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's an interesting idea, or thought, rather. Maybe we ought to keep our collective eyes open for any new UFO, civilian UFO groups in Great Britain and see what kind of military connections they have.
Yeah, it makes you think back to the original NICAP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Well, I mean, let's face it, investigations won't stop. On a positive note, perhaps civilian organizations will pick up the slack. They're going to have, you know, the phones aren't going to stop ringing, so they're going to have to be handed off somewhere. And much like it is in this country, if you call the police department, they'll tell you, well, we don't investigate UFO sightings, but here's a place that does, and they'll oftentimes hand you off to MUFON or Peter Davenport up at NARCAP or you know that kind of thing.
Yeah, it just amazes me. Anyway, have you got any new projects you're working on?
Well, I always have my hand in a half a dozen cases or better. We mildly touched on a few. I mentioned the Ramsey's book on Aztec. I have been tasked to write the chapter on, ironically, on Silas Newton. And I've been working on that, amongst other things. But Newton is an enigma unto himself. And of course, many people that are semi-familiar with the Aztec case, they throw the baby out with the bathwater because they believe that Newton was just this lowly con man. And the interesting thing about Silas Newton is if you go back to Frank Scully's book and read all the things that he said about Newton, I'm here to tell you that all of those things were true. He was a very, very wealthy man, in fact, more often than not. He was a big oil guy, and this isn't conjecture. I have the proof to back it up, and he was very well educated. And he was a pro golfer at one point, played all over the country. And all the people that Scully says that he was associated with and he rubbed elbows with in terms of movie stars and that kind of thing, he did. So it's a very, very interesting case with Silas Newton all by himself. In fact, it's a book all by itself. That's what I was joking with Scott. I says, you know, the one chapter might be bigger than the rest of the book could be. But no, it sitting at the helm of the UFO Chronicles, you know, we're a repository for information, and I get all these interesting reports all the time. So it's never a dull moment around here. And then, of course, just in separate research that I'm involved in, we mentioned Roswell early in the show. There's a couple new Roswell witnesses that have come to light, which happens more often than you might think. In fact, we got a new Roswell witness that we stumbled across while investigating Aztec within the last 48 hours. And this looks really, really exciting based on what this very credible person had to say. It's just never a dull moment. There's just so many things going on. I mildly mentioned during the break some things that's going on with the Paradise Valley case in Arizona. That is looking very exciting. And I had never paid too much attention to that, but some of the things that have come up on that have really got my attention. Back to Socorro, I found in the last 2 weeks one of the witnesses to the Socorro event, and I'm looking forward to interviewing him in the next few days, if he's willing to talk. I don't know. The last time that had come to light, he was shying away from any public interviews. But, you know, he's no spring chicken anymore, so perhaps he'll share what he knows. So there's always things going on. And, of course, we're all, you know, the website itself, we're growing exponentially. That's ever-expanding, and it's a chore unto itself, as you know, having your own website. So just all kinds of exciting things going on. And then and having recently guest hosted for Angela while she's recuperating. That's been a lot of fun. And
all of our best wishes and thoughts and prayers are with Angela as she recovers, and she will be back next week. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. She's
Awesome.
Ready to go.
Yeah, and then, as you were speaking about the Paradise Valley incident in the Dreamy Draw, which is the location of where this thing supposedly had gone down, here, 8-9 months ago, David and I met up with the local MUFON group, and they had mentioned that over the last 2 years, very large black triangular craft have been seen hovering, oh gosh, for an hour or so at a time, between Cave Creek, Dreamy Draw, Paradise Island, Paradise Valley area, north to an area called New River, over the course of the last 2 years.
Isn't that interesting?
And they're still looking for people to come forward with what they've seen and witnessed, because from what I understand, these things will stay there until they're chased away by military jets.
Huh.
And so anybody out there in that area between Cave Creek and New River that are listening tonight, contact the local MUFON group. They'd be more than happy to take your report, and confidentiality, again, is always the utmost.
Mm-hmm.
So don't hesitate.
Yeah, very important. The without getting into too much detail, you know, the Cave Creek incident was something that I had not paid too much attention to. But having looked into it in the last few months and speaking to some of the family members and whatnot, I do believe that what the primary witness saw, I believe he did see what he said he saw, based on the other information that I've dug up and in talking to the family. It's another very intriguing case. It's got my attention, most certainly. And then again, here you have, all these years later, more activity in the same geographical area. It just makes you wonder. There's another what if.
Exactly. We have a question from our virtual auditorium for you. This one's from Paul Dwarf, and he asks, did anything ever come out of the 1941 Cape Girardeau, Missouri case? Does Frank have any info on the Lummi Island incident off Seattle, Washington in 84?
Well, the first question, that the Cape Girardeau has been looked into a great deal, and I have spoken to the granddaughter. And that's another case that I give credence to. Based on everything that's on the table, the evidence is pretty solid that that the event that that the granddaughter alleges took place did take place. I really feel something happened there, like she says it did. And what was the case in 1984?
Let's see, the Lummi, L-U-M-M-I, Lummi Island incident off Seattle, Washington in 84.
You know, I'm not familiar with that case.
I'm not either.
I'll have to look into that. Well, my answer to that then would be, I don't know. But it's intriguing. If that person in the V room would want to drop me a line, just go to the UFO Chronicles and go down to the bottom left and click on Publisher there and send me an email and send me some details. I wouldn't mind looking into that. Or if that person has any knowledge on it or would like to go through the My UFO Experience portal and just share whatever they know about that, we could publish something on that.
He just posted in the room that, some way, if I'm understanding it correctly, that it's an incident similar to Shag Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So this is
so it's a USO.
Yes. This could be very interesting.
Yeah.
For looking
the plot thickens. I'm interested in that. Yeah.
He's saying, problem is, there isn't much on it. But there's two objects.
Well, perhaps we could change that. Now, there is one researcher who deals with nothing but USOs, USO cases for the most part. His name escapes me at the moment.
Is it Preston Bennett?
Is it Preston Bennett? I don't think that's who I'm thinking of.
Oh, gosh, the only one I can think of is Preston Bennett, because he concentrates on a lot of them.
Maybe it is.
The Catalina Island Channel.
Yeah.
Catalina Channel. David's looking. He'll come up with it. He's really good at that. And he's usually pretty quick with it.
Good deal.
But that's interesting. I'll have to see if I can't dig into that and see what I can find out, too. Paul Dwarfer says he's going to post a link to it. Oh, Carl Feint.
Yeah, that's who I was thinking of, yeah.
I wonder, David's good at that.
Check his website. Perhaps he has something there.
So, Paul Dwarfer, he will send us a link and check it out. This has got me intrigued, especially when you consider that I'm in the process of reading Rich Dolan's Volume 2 of UFOs in the National Security State, and I'm currently reading on 1984.
I haven't got his second book yet. I have to remedy that.
It's good. I recommend it. He covers mostly military incidents from all over the world and a few civilian incidences, but mostly military. And I'm hearing stuff in here that I'm like going, oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an incident I'm familiar with, but I never heard that part before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. Let's see. We've got about 12 minutes left. Yes. Thank you, David, for reminding me. Through emails and messages back and forth since yesterday, we had mentioned about a comment on the show you did for Angela last mm-hmm. night with Francis Barwood. And there had been a comment posted on that, semi-anonymously, I believe. I believe it is.
Well, somebody had it. Yeah,
like
a chat
nickname.
Yeah.
But this individual, and it's obviously a lady, because lady is in the nickname. This lady asked, why is Arizona being lambasted with UFO processes, debate, considerations? Are you that close to Area 51, or do you have your own underground areas to protect? Way too much Arizona discussions on the subject matter. Unless there is a viable plausibility, is there reason, and if so, what is the reason for the big hubbub? Well,
I don't know how you took that. I took that. The person must not have listened to the show. I mean, the answer was in listening to the show.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that.
Yeah. Francis, I was just overwhelmed by the interview. I mean, she dropped some bombs in that interview. I was just I thoroughly enjoyed it. And anybody that listened to the interview or knows anything about the Phoenix Lights, I didn't care, you know, what was this person thinking? The Phoenix Lights events, plural, is one of the biggest things in ufology. It's one of the top five cases of all time in terms of the scope of the event, the eyewitnesses, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's right up there with the Battle of L.A. Some might argue even a stronger case. You know, because of the multiple events and
Fife Symington coming out, almost 12 years later, and saying, have to admit, I saw it too.
Yeah, it goes on and on. I just thought that was a weird comment. I think it sounds to me as if the individual heard about what the show was going to be about and just didn't listen. Otherwise, they would have answered their own question.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. That I just kind of was surprised at that response to that program. It just, like you said, they were just not paying attention.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Oh, okay. You know, I had to get to your website. You know, I think your website is absolutely wonderful. It is one of the most informative, not just on news relating to the UFO topic, but, I mean, you've got reader reports, videos, you know, you just about name it and you have it.
Why, thank you, ma'am.
It must keep you awful darn busy.
It does. Yeah. I have got it set up. You know, we've got several scripts in there. So as information hits the internet that is UFO related, it pops up in real time automatically on the website. So we don't miss anything. And then of course we have several contributors that. Send us their pen script on a regular basis, and then we have new people that come in oftentimes to write about the subject matter. I'm a little bit more particular with individual articles in regards to just news in general. From a journalistic point of view, I'm more accepting on, you know, something that comes in that venue. It's a funny hat that I have to wear because oftentimes people think we endorse something if we publish something, and that's not the case. I may publish an individual's article and disagree with it entirely. I don't have to agree with it to publish it, but it has to be, you know, in fact, somebody asked the other day if they could submit some articles, and I said, well, certainly you could, we'll do it on an article-by-article basis. I says, in general, you know, they have to be well-written, well-researched, pithy, and hopefully they're not espousing some agenda or ideology. That's what I want to shy away from. I don't have to agree with it. I caught a little flack a month or so ago because I published I'll be polite and say a skeptic's article. And I wrote back and I said, look, just because I published it didn't mean I agreed with it, but I felt that there were some good arguments, and I published it, and I said, you know, there's a comment section. Use it. We invite people to, you know, put in their two cents.
And it's just another article that you have on here that you wrote about Peckman getting his initiative on the ballot.
Yes.
Do you think that'll carry?
No, I don't. And I personally don't think it does ufology any favors. And I've often said to people that ufology needs an agent. And sadly, it's not necessarily the action. There can be very valiant efforts, and not to say that this isn't one of those valiant efforts. But there's a game, it's almost a chess game we have to play with the media, and the perception of the actions that are taken. What will happen with this, and what has happened is the media grabs it, runs with it, and makes light of it. In that regard, it just does not do ufology any favors. Also, then they look at Peckman individually. He has done this thing not too many years ago in another venue that had nothing to do with ufology in terms of, you know, he tried to pass an ordinance, and it says in that article where they, you know, they wanted to pipe peaceful music into buildings and, you know, do this, all this other kind of thing. And, of course, that was trounced by the voters in a big way. And then there were some other shenanigans that he was involved in, and not to pick on Peckman, but the idea to have a body look into ufology in any government or scientific way, in fact, that's the key word, science, it doesn't need it doesn't and can't belong to a single city. It needs to be done on a federal level. It needs to be done with scientists and a larger, more informative body. And I just don't see any good that can come from that whatsoever. And it's not going to pass anyway. some people may disagree with that, but you heard it here first.
It would be interesting if it did. You know, it would show how many people in the state of Colorado, you know, are interested in
that. If that passes, I will come to your new house that you're getting, and I will eat your hat. But
well,
I agree with you.
Would you prefer felt or velvet?
You pick which one you want to lose. Get the salt out.
Oh, gosh. But it would be interesting if it did. You know, I'm like you. I'm skeptical. Is it passing? But, you know, it would be interesting if it did.
It would speak volumes if it did. But sadly, I don't think that that's going to be the case. Now, having said that, I think the idea is good if it was done in the right way. I just don't think doing that at a city level, that's not where you want to spend your energy. A body does need to exist, but not down that low. It needs to be, at the very least, at the federal level, and or a separate scientific body. All for that, all for the notion, but not in this regard.
I agree, because there are so many cities. Well, Phoenix, for example, is so hard-pressed on their budgets right now that they're having to cut funding for schools and unemployment and all this other stuff, and they still can't make their budgets balance.
Well, and some of the opponents, the arguments, in fact, one of the council members by the name of Brown, who fought Peckman on his other deal that he tried to get on the ballot several years ago, his argument is that in order to get these initiatives on the ballot, you need like a very small percentage of the total mayoral vote of the previous election. And of course, in this state, in California, that's how Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected. You only needed 10% of the total vote of the previous election to do a recall election. And of course, he had deep pockets, and that came to light. And ironically, he's now in the same boat that the previous governor is in. I don't know that he's happy that he took the job at this point. But the argument for Brown in Denver is that they need to change that law so these frivolous initiatives don't get put on the ballot. Now, whether it's up to each individual whether you think that that's frivolous or not, I personally don't think that this does ufology any good. You're going to get the giggle factor again. This is going to be in the news. We're going to hear a lot about this up until they vote it down. And they're going to make light of ufology. In that regard, it just does not help us. And of course, Peckman, because it's come to light again, he'll be on David Letterman again or other places like that. And I just don't think that's the fight we need to fight. I don't think it helps. I think it hurts. But that's my 2 cents.
Okay, we have just a little bit less than a minute to go. Is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners, and also, you know, your website?
One of the things that we've been trying to do, you know, we do have the My UFO Experience portal, and we get information that comes in on that all the time. I've been trying at every opportunity to ask that if there's any military listeners out there, whether active or retired, if they've ever had any UFO experiences that they'd like to share. You can go to the site, go to the top of the site and click share your UFO experience. That'll pull up your email protocol, and then and share the experience. I've been trying to get a lot more that we, and what precipitated this is that we have in fact had some reports come in that were had a military flavor to them, and they're just really, they're very, very exciting, and some of them have been some pretty heavyweight reports. So, just trying to pick that up a little bit. If there's and that's not to say that, I mean, anybody, civilian or whatnot, if you've had a UFO experience, we'd love to hear from you. And very much like articles. Many people will hear me say that, and then they'll send in two sentences. They'll say, well, I saw a UFO last Thursday, and that's the end of it. You know, it's almost like your house catches on fire, and you call the fire department and say, my house is on fire, click. You know, well, you know, explain
exactly
the report. Make it a report. Tell me what happened. What time was it? Where were you? What did
details,
it look like?
Details.
How large was it? How were you affected?
The details are everything.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's UFOChronicles.com, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, Frank, we are out of time.
Doesn't it go by so fast?
Too darn fast sometimes. And I want to thank you again for joining us tonight on such a short notice.
Anytime.
I deeply appreciate it.
Anytime.
This time of year, it gets pretty darn difficult to get people scheduled.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah. It's been fun.
You've been absolutely wonderful. I have enjoyed this tonight.
Well, thank you. Right back at you.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium tonight. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight is author Lillian Bromet. Please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.
Good night.